listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Much in the news today, in particular some financial news that I'm going to get to a little later on in the program. But the Financial Times has a couple of stories up, and those of you who are Financial Times junkies already know what I'm talking about. And it's 2006 all over again. I'll tell you all about that in a little bit. The weather finally, it was still below freezing when I got up this morning. The boat didn't freeze up, but the river is starting to thaw. But, we had that interesting conversation some weeks ago with a climatologist about how because the Arctic is warming four times faster than the mid-latitudes in North America, that temperature gradient, the difference in temperature between the North American air and the Arctic air, that gradient, that difference in temperature is not as great as it was just 20 years ago. And, of course, with a storm, like when a cold front moves through, you know, the cold air behind and the warm air in front, the difference in the two temperatures is what determines how strong the storm is, how great the winds are. And so if you got really warm air or really cold air, you're going to have a really big storm. If there's only a few degrees difference, you might get a few raindrops. Similarly, the temperature gradient between the North American air mass or the northern hemisphere air mass and the polar air mass used to be the difference in temperature used to be quite substantial, and it kept the jet stream up to the north. It has declined substantially because the polar regions are warming four times faster than our region. The planet itself has warmed about 1.4 degrees in the last 50 years and Celsius. And so the consequence of this is that, you know, all this polar air is slopping down on top of us. Totally counterintuitive. Global warming is making it colder. Now, into this steps the folks who say, well, gee, let's dump more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Daniel Weber is with us, the founder of the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC.us is their website. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks for having AMAC on, and I appreciate this discussion.
So, I spent some time on your website. I read your article, We Need a New Energy Policy, which people can read at AMAC.us. And it seems to me rather frankly disturbing. You're using the bubble in North Dakota, which happens whenever, you know, large deposits of oil get discovered and you haven't had enough time to get workers there and infrastructure there, to suggest that if we only let the oil industry go nuts, everybody would be making $50 an hour, and that more carbon in our atmosphere is going to be more jobs. I think it's going to be more. It is going to be in a lot more jobs. It'll be in a lot more jobs rebuilding places like the damage from Hurricane Sandy and the damage from Hurricane Katrina and the damage from the mile-wide tornadoes. And
yeah, Tom, I think the science is out on that stuff. But you know what I think we would both agree on is solar.
Science is not out. The science is in, Daniel.
What causes the ice cap in Iceland to melt?
Heat.
Not carbon dioxide, but particles, minute particles of dark material that attracts the sun that leaves little puddles on the ice. The puddles become bigger, and the puddles draw more energy and causes the ice to melt further.
The diminished albedo effect is one of multiple factors, Daniel, but if you bothered to read the IPCC report, you'd see that it's actually it's a much smaller factor than the fact that we now have more than 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, a number that has never been reached in the history of the human race.
Well, tell me what caused the ice over Manhattan, which was 1 mile thick, 10,000 years ago, to melt.
It had nothing to do with human activity. Tell me what caused the great dying off 250 million years ago in the Permian mass extinction.
Hey, do you want to talk about solar and wind?
Well, the point I want to make is that if you're saying that the science is out, you're wrong.
Well, we can argue about that. But
no, we can't. There is no argument. The science is in. Global warming is real. Global warming is being caused by greenhouse gases in large part. And as you correctly point out, soot in the air, which is the result of burning these fossil fuels as well. And you're arguing that we should have more of this. And that seems to me like not just suicidal, but actually homicidal toward future generations.
I'm not. I'm saying solar and wind.
This is not what I'm reading. What I'm reading here is that you're saying
temporary.
Weber believes the federal government needs to reconsider. We need to reconsider our green agenda in light of the technological progress the energy sector has made.
The short term, we've got a lower energy cost for American families.
Why?
And we've got because American families want to live better.
So instead of lowering energy costs, why don't we put the same amount of, instead of giving subsidies to the oil industries, why don't we help people insulate their homes?
Okay. But let's talk about replacing the carbon causing energy with solar and wind. And tell me why the Interior Department has put a ban on 30 million acres for solar and wind. They've only allowed 600,000 acres to be used. They just built a 5-square-mile solar collector in New Mexico, which is going to work. It's going to heat or provide energy for 70,000 homes, and it works. And I like solar. And yet the Interior Department is saying, no, we got 30 million other acres, and the federal government is not allowing private enterprise to develop it for wind.
Are they allowing on those 30 million acres, are they allowing us to develop it for, say, office buildings?
No. We need
it's pristine. You're talking about Yellowstone. I mean, of course they're going to say, no, you're not going to turn it into a solar collector.
We're talking about vast wastelands all over the country, and you know that.
Vast wastelands that are part of our national heritage and that are part of our natural ecosystems.
Tom, the problem is this administration does not want to follow the law.
That's nonsense. This
administration. The judge found the Interior Department contempt of court for continue to slow down the Gulf of Mexico drilling permits. I can go on and on and on.
Yeah, I know. You want more drilling. You want more fossil fuel. That, you know, if the administration is trying to stop that, I'm all in favor of it.
I like natural gas because that's a very clean. And we need to.
No, the study that came out this week shows that it's not clean. It's actually producing the roughly the same amount of greenhouse gas as all the other forms because of the leakage because of fracking. You've got this enormous amount of leakage that is more than making up for, you know, so these green buses that are burning natural gas, they're putting the same amount when you consider the leakage from the CO2. And not only that, the fracking's poisoning our water supplies.
Yeah, can I talk briefly about the Olympics real quick?
Certainly.
Okay, Lindsey Vonn, the downhill ski racer, she had to be replaced in the Olympics. And you know who they wanted to replace her with?
No.
Barack Obama. You know why?
No.
Because he's going downhill faster than anybody. And part of it is the lack of energy policy. We need to have an energy policy to lower the cost for American families.
Did you hear the president's speech today?
Pardon me?
Did you hear the president's speech today about energy policy?
I've been working all day. Actually, I've been busy working all day.
Okay. Well, the president gave a speech today about his energy policy in which he suggested that we should be dialing back. In fact, not suggested. He's instituting policies that are going to require cars to be more fuel efficient.
Without Congress again ignoring our Constitution?
You mean the way Ronald Reagan did and George W. Bush did?
The issues
more times than Barack Obama has?
And I'm not saying I agree with that either, Tom.
Yeah, well, it's not explicitly laid out in the Constitution that a president can sign an executive order, but he is given the authority, he's given the job of carrying out the laws. How do you do that without an executive order?
And we're on the same side on that.
I guess. Daniel Weber is the founder of the Association of Mature American Citizens, AMAC.us is the website. Daniel, thank you for dropping by today.
Great talking, Tom.
Okay, good talking with you, too. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on? I'm not going to try and sing it, but you know the song. We'll be back. And welcome back, Nate Sweet, producer with the big picture on the line with us. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Good, good. So, red states are closing hospitals, huh?
Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable trend. All over the country, we're seeing closures of hospitals, especially in rural areas, and a lot of experts have tied it to the failure of about 25 red states to, or not only red states, but Republican-controlled states to expand Obamacare's Medicaid. Follow through on Obamacare's Medicaid expansion provision.
Right. And what this boils down to is when Reagan was president, you know, he was getting all this flack for people were dying and hospitals were turning them away. And he said, well, that's wrong. And so a law was passed. I think it was 86. And
yeah, it was.
Okay. Thank you. That said that hospitals, basically, if somebody shows up and they're in serious trouble, you know, they're bleeding out or they're having a heart attack or something, the hospital has to take them in and fix them, or at least triage them, you know, put them, stabilize them before they can even ask them if they can pay. And, you know, which just kind of makes sense. But the result of this is that in areas where there's a large number of uninsured people, those people are using the hospital emergency rooms, not just for emergencies, but for pretty much everything.
Primary care, essentially.
Right. And, you know, the way that law was written during the Reagan period, we paid the bill. And so Obamacare, if the Medicaid expansion had been picked up by these 25 Republican states, that Medicaid expansion would have paid the bill. In other words, everybody who shows up at the ER or any part of the hospital would have an insurance card, whether it was a Medicaid insurance card or, you know, one of the big companies. And so these hospitals would stop losing money.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's part of it, too. In a lot of instances, there are some of these hospitals that, you know, have other financial problems at stake, but the Obamacare Medicaid expansion would be a great way for them to get new patients who could bring money into the hospital system. And Republicans apparently don't like free enterprise, because that's what they're preventing from happening here by refusing to expand Medicaid.
I think they just don't like poor people.
Right. Well,
I mean, you know, that's the net, because they love free enterprise when it comes to banks. They just, I don't know if you saw the Financial Times today, but I'll give you the headlines. U.S. regulators soften risk retention rule on residential mortgages. And then the one that follows that, U.S. lenders return to securitizing mortgages.
Back. History repeating itself.
Ta-da-da! 2006 is back. Anyway. Our big picture politics panel, Laurie Sanders, Nate Sweet, and Huey Newsom.
Yep, I'll be on it again. Huey's a veteran. Laurie hasn't been on the show in quite a while, or hasn't been on before. She may have been on before I was here, but she's good nonetheless. We're going to have a good panel discussion. We'll not just be talking about, you know, sort of another issue related to Obamacare and the Reagan era law that requires companies, hospitals, to treat people that come in to the hospital. We'll be talking about that in relation to a California bill that's been introduced in that state's legislature that would create an Obamacare-type system using state money for undocumented immigrants. We'll be getting our panelists' thought on that. We'll also be talking about some of these attacks that Republican politicians, especially Rand Paul, have been making on Hillary Clinton, specifically in regards to the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which is, you know, more than 10 years old at this point. I'm sort of surprised that they're still talking about that, but we'll try to dig into that. We'll also be talking about new disclosures by Lee Fong about the TPP, the UAW vote down in Chattanooga, and then in Block C, we'll be talking to two climate change experts on solutions using decentralization. We talked to a former Olympic athlete. Daily Take is on...
something else.
Yeah.
It's great. Nate Sweet. Thank you, Nate.
Yeah.
Great having you. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I mentioned this to Nate just a minute ago. This is, you can imagine my jaw dropping. I just wrote this book, The Crash of 2016, that talks about how, you know, the securitization of mortgages. What does that mean, securitization of mortgages? It means that a bank goes out and they write $1 million worth of mortgages, or $1 billion worth of mortgages. And then they bundle those mortgages up. Now, those mortgages have a primary value, and they resell them to other banks. Okay, so, but they slice it into pieces. So the risk is distributed and diffuse and whatnot. And these are called tranches. So some other bank buys, let's say, a $200 million slice of that. And then they get insurance on that mortgage. You know, is it going to pay or not pay? and let's say they insure it 2-to-1. So now you got $400 million worth of insurance on the $200 million mortgage. You've now created $600 million worth of economic activity out of the original $200 million mortgage. Then they would find somebody else who would take a bet on whether the insurance was going to fail and do a 2-to-1 bet on that. So that $400 million becomes $800 million. And, you know, and the price process goes on. And in 2006, we got to the point where there's $600 trillion worth of these kind of bets. And a lot of it got dialed back with Dodd-Frank, which was passed in the wake of the financial crisis and disaster and all this. You know, there's some small attempt. We didn't bring back Glass-Steagall. We didn't undo even, frankly, a quarter of the damage that Phil Graham did with his Enron bills in 99 and 2000. Graham, Leach, Bliley, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. Didn't even do a fraction of that. But we at least slowed down in the United States, and thus for much of the international banking system, because our banks collaborate with other people's banks, slowed down this securitization. Securitization means basically, will you place a bet on this mortgage? The underlying mortgage is the security, right? And then we're going to bet on that. It has an underlying value, and then you derive from that underlying value the bet. Thus, they call them derivatives. So I'm looking at the Financial Times this morning, as I am wont to do, and no, they are not a sponsor of this program. It's just, I'm telling you, it's fascinating to read rich people talking to rich people. Although most of the people who write at the Financial Times are probably not rich people, they know for whom they are writing. And these two stories were side by side on the, and they're there right now on the homepage. The first was, our regulators, Louise and I just went through this. Our son just bought a house, and it was like, whoa, you know, all the paperwork. It was like weeks of paperwork, and just, it was incredible. Well, U.S. regulators, Tracy Alloway in New York writes for the Financial Times, have moved to boost the country's housing recovery. Now, I would say that's a euphemism for let's reinflate the bubble. Back to Tracy. By softening the new rules, really? That would force banks to hold a slice of packaged mortgage loans. See, it used to be that the banks had to hang on to a piece of it. So if they're going to sell all this risk, you remember Senator Carl Levin on the Senate committee where he was grilling, what was it, Fabulous Fab, the banker? And he was saying, now you said in this email that these were, you know, S-wordy mortgages, and you were going to dump these S-wordy mortgages on this person and that person, and you were laughing about it, and is that the case? And, you know, only he was actually, Carl Levin, Senator Levin, was actually dropping the S-word on the air. And the guy was going, yeah, we were scamming people. He was, by the way, the only guy that was really seriously held responsible, the Jamie Dimons of the world. They just get another $10 million bonus. So, anyhow, the rule said that if a bank is going to sell his crap, they've got to keep a chunk of it themselves, and that will discourage them from making it really, really, really bad stuff. Because presumably they don't want to have really, really, they'll have real bad stuff on their books, but not really, really, really bad stuff on their books. So here's the story. U.S. regulators have moved to boost the country's housing recovery by softening new rules that would force banks to hold a slice of packaged mortgage loans. Used to be you had to put down 20% and you had to have what's called a debt-to-income ratio. In other words, they'd look at all your debt, your credit cards, your student loans, all that stuff, and look at your annual income. And if your debt was more than 36% of your annual income, they figured you couldn't afford to buy a house. And they wouldn't write the loan for you. However, Tracy Alloway in New York writes in the Financial Times, however, on Wednesday? Today's Tuesday, isn't it? February 18th, August 28th. Oh, very interesting. The February 18th story, this is an older story. Well, this is from last summer. Oh, this is fascinating. So they changed this last summer, but they still have... Okay, so great. Okay, I now understand the cause and effect. However, on Wednesday, the Federal Reserve and five other U.S. financial regulators suggested that qualified residential mortgages could include loans with a down payment of only 10% and a higher debt-to-income ratio of 43%. Okay, so they loosened things up since last summer. Have you noticed, by the way, that the housing market has picked up since last summer? So now there's more mortgages floating around. Now we get to the article that was just above that link in the Financial Times. That was the main headline. U.S. lenders return to securitized mortgages. And they talk about how this guy, Chris Haspel, who developed the new mortgage rules to prevent a rerun of the subprime boom. And I quote from Tracy again. This is today's paper. Now he, this is Chris Haspel, he is a part of a growing industry seeking to profit from making loans that fall outside the new qualified mortgage regulation that he helped author.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
She adds, this leaves a potentially lucrative opening for specialist performers such as hedge funds and non-bank lenders. Run! Okay, and here's another one that I think is worth considering. The lead story at the top of the New York Times right now. Is headlined, Ukraine police storm square in deadliest day of uprising. They've got a photo of flames, police against the flames, the riot police in Kiev going up against the protesters. Just to recap, and I want to probably tomorrow, Steve Cohen or one of these other, you know, just genuine experts on this topic, want to get them on the program and do an extended conversation about this. So I'm not going to try and do it right now other than just alerting you to this. That this has the potential to be Sarajevo 1914. This has the potential to provoke a world war. You've got Ukraine, the western half of Ukraine, speaks Ukrainian, ethnic Ukrainian. They consider themselves part of Europe. The eastern half of Ukraine speaks Russian, is largely ethnically Russian, and they consider themselves, for all practical purposes, part of Russia or affiliated with Russia. The current president is from the east. In fact, he didn't even speak Ukrainian until after he was 50 years old. What's his name? Yushchenko, I think. And the western half wants to join the EU. The eastern half wants to go, you know, take this deal that President Putin is offering them. I'm not offering any moral judgments on this. I don't see good guys and bad guys here. What I see is a situation that could be a crisis. That is a crisis. I mean, you don't have people rioting in the streets, burning cars, setting police on fire, and not call it a crisis. It's unlikely that the country is going to split in half, but at some point, I mean, if they decide to say no to Russia and yes to the EU, to the European Union, you're going to have the eastern half of Ukraine, which is going to be very upset. If they say yes to Russia, no to the EU, you're going to have the western half of Ukraine, which is going to be very upset. Up to this point, up until recently, they've been sort of saying, you know, we'll play footsie with both of you. But now the Obama administration had a diplomat say, you know, basically, you know, we're in charge of making, you know, of deciding what's going to happen in the Ukraine. Screw the EU. Which wasn't, you know, we're going to throw them into Russia's arms. It was more like, you know, we're going to take charge of the situation. And the whole world went, huh? Really? Especially the Russians. So just keep an eye on the situation. There's probably tomorrow, might be a little later in the week, but I want to do an entire hour on this. I really want to drill down deep into this. This is something that we all, you're not going to learn anything other than the bumper stickers on the American news, because all we have is infotainment in America anymore. So, you know, tragically, people have to turn to alternative media or frankly, talk radio. To get any kind of meaningful conversation, any kind of deep drilling down. I mean, even NPR now is taking money from billionaires and running scam pieces on how pension funds are melting down. not NPR, Corporation PBS, the TV branch. NPR instead is got Mara Liasson on and loves to go on Fox and smile every time Charles Krauthammer talks about how terrible the president is and you know, and goes on the radio presenting the Republican point of view, shall we say, charitably. It's, you know, the media in this country is just a, you know, it's a real sad state of affairs. We are at an absolute screaming crisis point in so many different areas. And there are so many opportunities as a consequence of that for us to do something about it. We are facing an ecological crisis, which could in a couple of generations mean the dying off of billions of human beings and other species. And that is associated with an incredible opportunity to leave behind 19th century fossil fuels and move into 21st century energy sources. And what's holding us back? The Supreme Court said that the First Amendment protects money, the 14th Amendment protects corporations, and so you've got a bunch of cranky oil billionaires like the Koch brothers, and you got a whole bunch of oil companies, ExxonMobil and BP and everybody else, who are funding climate denial, global warming deniers, and are buying politicians to the point that you literally have senators on the floor of the Senate talking about this being a hoax. Other countries are doing something about it, but we're not. So that's one crisis. Another crisis we have is economic. We had an economy that for 50 years worked really well and was really stable and really solid and built the strongest and healthiest and most vibrant middle class that the world had ever seen from the 1950s until the 1980s. Forty years, depending on how you calculate it, of absolute prosperity. Yeah, there were a few, you know, recessions and freakouts in there from time to time, but it was 4 decades of over 3% GDP growth every year, and we built this extraordinary country. And then Reaganomics came along. Reagan came into office, and for 30 years we haven't rebuilt our physical infrastructure at all. It's falling apart around us, and we stopped investing in our intellectual infrastructure, and now our intellectual infrastructure has become a profit source for us. Our children are $1 trillion in debt on student loans when we should be paying for their education. This is the future of America. That's the opportunity. There's this incredible opportunity. Let's forgive student debt and reorganize how we do schools. Let's do what Abe Lincoln did. He set up the land-grant colleges. Let's make it so anybody can go to college for free. Let's do what Thomas Jefferson did. He established the University of Virginia, the first free college in America for everybody. So there's a crisis and an opportunity. We have the banksters. We have the, you know, these deregulated banks that are just, you know, they're running amok. You got six banks that control assets worth 65% of the entire gross domestic product of the United States. All the money bought, everything bought and sold in America. They own an amount of money equal to roughly two-thirds of that. They're bigger than they were before the crash in 2008. There's been no serious effort to hold any of them accountable. Did you see this piece in, I think it was New York Magazine, where this reporter crashed this party at the St. Regis in New York, where a bunch of billionaires were getting together and you know, it was all well choreographed and basically making fun of all of us for being suckers, for bailing out the banks and things. I mean, singing songs about, you know, we got the bailout. And these are literally billionaires, a room full of billionaires. Krista Freeland, in her book Plutocrats, as I recall, that was the title of her book. Krista Freeland, for years, was a senior editor with the Financial Times. And I read her work for years. I have so much respect for Krista Freeland. I have no idea where she is now. But, you know, once she wrote that book, she's in the what? The Canadian Parliament? Krista Freeland ran for Parliament in Canada? Wow. Good on her. Shane believes that to be the case. He's going to check it out. But in any case, she was brilliant, is brilliant. And I read her book, and her book talks about how back around the turn of the 19th century, there was this wealthy family in New York, and they threw this lavish party in New York City, and poverty was growing exponentially, very, very rapidly, as was massive wealth. It was just like now. And that was the breaking point for Americans, was while people outside that house were standing in line to get bread or unable to get medical treatment or eating moldy bread crusts, inside the party, people were being given jewels, and they were drinking out of goblets and, you know, very expensive cut glass goblets. And I mean, it's just Christopher Freeland's book is amazing. I'm wondering if this party that got crashed, if this thing goes viral far enough, and it's over at the New Yorker. There's a link to it at the Democratic Underground right now, but it's in a lot of other places. I read the whole article this morning. It's horrifying. I mean, this is not the top 1%, by the way. This is the top 100th or 1,000th or 1/10,000th of 1%. These are the few thousand people who own most of the wealth of our nation, or much of the wealth of our nation, and delight in it. Yesterday, I shared with you at some length that scientific study that was finally done in the UK. Somebody did a study on what happens to the political opinions of people when they get wealthy. And what easier way to find out than by, you know, with a randomized sample than by looking at lottery winners. So you're not looking at people who got wealthy because they worked really hard, so they have a strong work ethic, and therefore they're conservative. No, you're talking about people who just got rich because they hit the jackpot. They become conservative. Why? Because conservative is just a euphemism for on the side of the rich. As John Kenneth Galbraith said, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness. He was right then. It's right now. And so I wonder if this is a tipping point. And that on top of this headline in today's Financial Times, U.S. lenders return to securitized mortgages. Is that really?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So now we're back to the gray market in derivatives. Exploding. I'm going to pick up your calls after this quarter up. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Corky at Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, this global warming, Everybody's concerned about burning fossil fuels into the air.
Yeah.
Nobody's concerned about what's happening to the Earth itself.
A lot of us are, actually. But go on.
Well, the oil is the lubricant that the Earth uses for its tectonic plate movements. When you suck that oil out, it's the same as if you suck it out of your car. The metals heat up and they finally weld together. The water boils away. This is all happening within the Earth. You cannot suck that amount of oil out because the Earth cannot replenish it that quickly. And you leave caverns underneath the surface. And when you're fracking, you're cracking the very mantle of the Earth. So how long do you think before it actually implodes on itself?
Well, it's an interesting theory, Corky. I'm pretty certain, though, that if you look at what are called subduction zones, and this is where one mass of land collides with another mass of land and typically is riding up over it or riding under it, and they're called plates, these masses of land. And if you look at these subduction zones where these plates are colliding, there's typically not oil there, at least at the level of where the rock is striking the rock. And that's why you get earthquakes, is because the rock, the pressure builds up and then it lets go and goes, and boom, you got an earthquake. Do you know something I don't?
No, I know the Earth is a living, breathing planet.
Yes.
And it supplies the things necessary for its survival.
Yes.
And I believe oil is a part of that.
Okay. I wouldn't disagree with that in the abstract. And in fact, I'd go so far as to say, you know, what the Earth does is it always tries to return to homeostasis, to a static, a homeostatic environment, to a static environment that's friendly to life. And that means sequestering carbon out of the air to a level where it's appropriate for the current type of plant life anyway, and animal life. And it does so by, you know, rotting plant matter in the seas, settles to the bottom of the ocean, becomes either frozen methane hydrates, or becomes oil. And rotting plant matter on the surface of the planet rots and falls to the earth and eventually gets, you know, rock builds up on top of it under great pressure, and that becomes coal. And with appropriate pressure, that coal may also, in some cases, become oil. I don't disagree with you that we're messing with Mother Nature big time. I absolutely agree with that. And
you're not gonna stop them from taking oil out of the ground until they have sucked every dollar of its worth.
Well, I think there's a really easy way to do that, and that is to charge them for it. And then, you know, if you say, okay, fine, if you want to produce energy out of oil out of the ground, great. Here's the tax. Here's the tax on carbon. You're going to have to pay to dispose of your waste. And so, you know, I mean, the EU has started with $15 carbon tax. There's proposals in the United States for $10 to $15 carbon tax. There are countries where the carbon tax is as high as $100 a ton on carbon dioxide. And I believe that Ireland is one of them, and Finland or Denmark is another. I'm pretty sure it was Finland. I've interviewed folks from those countries, but I'm doing this on memory, so I'm reluctant to assert it absolutely. But this is what we need to be doing. We need to be putting a price on carbon. I'm with you, Corky. Thanks a lot for the call. So the president, welcome back 10 minutes before the hour. The president gave a speech this morning and said he's going to reduce the pollution coming out of the tailpipes of trucks by the year after next. Good on him for that. The pollution coming out of trucks, not only A, the carbon pollution contributes to global warming, but B, the particulate pollution and the chemical pollution, the high hydrocarbon fractions, the benzenes and whatnot, cause asthmas and cancers. So I'm all for that. I think that's a marvelous thing. John in Geneva, Illinois. John, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening to TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Thank you, Tom. I love this show. I blew a call in a couple minutes ago to my congressman, who's Randy Hultgren here in the 19th District in Illinois. And I said, I have a simple question. Does the congressman believe that climate change is brought on by human activity or not? And if so, what does he plan to do about it? They put me on hold. I said, please hold. 15 minutes later, he picks the phone up again, and he says, we're going to have to, the congressman's going to have to get back to you on that. And I said, I didn't realize that was such a challenging question because it's nowhere on his website. So, and this guy, Tom, is the, Randy Hultgren is on the Science and National Labs Caucus. He's one of the leading members of the caucus.
Is he a Democrat or a Republican?
Oh my goodness. He's a Republican.
Oh, well.
We got redistricted. We got gerrymandered out here. We used to have Bill Foster, who's, a very good Democrat, a very progressive guy, and a self-made guy. Mr. Hultgren, he inherited the family a funeral home business, so he made it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, right. He inherited it. Yeah.
So, this is the problem. You know, this guy's on it. He's apparently a leading member of this committee, a science committee, and I can't get a straight answer out of him about where he's at on climate change.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because he doesn't want to risk the money that he's getting from the fossil fuel industry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's a Tea Party guy too. So,
yeah.
You're the receiving end of my little rant.
Okay. Well, John, you know, good on you for calling your member of Congress. If everybody listening to this program were to do that just once a week, or even once a month, about one issue, and here's a couple tips, and I'm sure John, you would validate these. For calling your member of Congress is, number one, be polite. Number two, ask one simple question or make one simple statement. Don't say, here's my laundry list. Would you please write all these things down? If you've got three things you want to talk about, call on three different days, three different times. And number three, if possible, follow it up with a letter or a call to a local district as well as to the D.C. office. In fact, the local districts are even better because then they know that you're actually a voter.
And I've heard you suggest that many times, and that is what I do. I'll put it in writing because it does take a little, as you've said, it puts a little more weight behind it. It takes a little longer.
A lot more
effort.
Weight.
Yes.
It's like 1,000 to 1. I've talked to members of Congress, and they say, you know, people who send me emails, I might get 10,000 emails and I'll pay something attention to something. People who call, I might get 400 calls and I'll pay attention to something. Somebody sends me a handwritten letter, if I get 10 of those, I'll pay attention to it. So, somebody who comes and shows up at my office, it might just take 2 or 3. It's amazing the power of citizen lobbying. So
I'm wondering if I'll get an answer back from the congressman.
Yeah,
I'll be curious.
Well, if he has an office in your district, and I'm sure he does. He probably has several of them.
Yes, he does. Yeah.
Yeah, you might want to just drop by and say hi and say this is an issue for me, and here's my name and address, and just want to let you know I'm a voter.
I'll probably get the same form letter that I've got.
Oh, of course you will. Of course you will. But if enough people do it, it will reach a critical mass. At some point, these guys are going to get it that they can't continue, lying to people and basically mistreating them or ignoring them or trying to, just feed them a line that's an excuse for not participating in the greatest crisis of our time. John, thank you for the call, and thanks for your activism. Good on you. I salute you. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind today?
Very brilliant advice you gave the guy.
Well, he was living it. I was more giving it to everybody else because he's doing it. God bless him.
It's real good because I believe that in order to motivate people to action, they need to hear at least as much hope or specific methods of how to improve things as atrocities.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree. In fact, one of my rules of thumb is I try not to talk about an issue if I can't offer a solution because I don't want people to just walk away, ready to slit their wrists. And frankly, I can't think of anything right now for which I don't see a solution. Now, some of those solutions are going to require mind-boggling amounts of work, like amending the Constitution. But that doesn't mean it's not there, it's not possible, and there's not people working really, really hard, like over at movetoamend.org, to do it.
Yeah. That's right. So on the order of hope, I want to say that there are people, in terms of energy and climate, there are people all over the world that are working on incredible new methods of sustainable energy that we haven't heard about.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to give you two.
Okay.
That I just love. One of them is a new form of collecting energy from ocean waves. And instead of putting the collector on the top of the shore where the waves can hit it, you put it on the bottom and you collect the heat that is accumulating in the sand because of the waves hitting them. And this has two advantages. One is that they don't get broken when the wind gets to be 80 miles an hour and the waves get too big. And the other is that the bottom of the ocean stays warm, so it's less intermittent. It's more steady.
So you're not suggesting this is kinetic heat. This is, heat, the consequence of motion. This is heat that's simply brought in from the ocean through mixing of water layers and
exactly,
with wave power.
And the wave, the kinetic energy, is communicated as heat to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, but that's got to be fairly small level of energy, isn't it?
And then you collect that heat. But here's the kicker. There's a researcher in my hometown in Berkeley and the university. And by the way, my shout outs to Harvey, who's doing this, and he's not getting any money from the government. He's having to crowdsource it.
Whoa. Do you have a link for where he's doing it?
What?
Do you have a link for where he's doing it?
His name is Marcus Lehman, and if you talk about...
Okay, we gotta wrap it up, Lawrence. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Politico is reporting a new massive, you know, Paul Singer, the billionaire. Greg Palast has written at some length about Paul Singer, billionaire hedge fund guy out of New York, involved in buying up, as I recall, Argentinian bonds, you know, penny on the dollar, I think. But in any case, he's a big Republican donor. They're launching, quietly expanding their political footprint ahead of the midterm elections to try to shape the direction of the Republican Party. It's really interesting because what we're seeing are the libertarian billionaires, the Koch brothers, the I just want to get rich billionaires, the old money billionaires, the Wall Street billionaires, the Silicon Valley billionaires. And they all have slightly different agendas, but they all kind of fit into this Republican Party big tent of billionaires for billionaires. And in many cases, they run businesses where we use their products or we use their applications, and we say, sure, I'll sign those terms and conditions. You ever get an app and it says, or you join a website or you join anything. And you have to click the little box before you can proceed that says, yes, I read the terms and conditions. Did you ever read the terms and conditions? Last month, I had a chance to talk to John McAfee, the founder of the popular McAfee computer security programs. And we talked about how people usually don't read the terms and conditions of the smartphone apps that they download onto their phones. But McAfee says that he did read the terms and conditions of the Bank of America smartphone app, and what he saw was pretty shocking. McAfee told me that by agreeing to the terms and conditions for the Bank of America application, quoting him, you give the Bank of America application, which is the remote banking application, the permission to turn on your phone and make phone calls at your expense and without telling you, to turn on your camera and microphone without telling you at any time, and to transmit pictures and sound files. End of quote. Now, you may not exactly be signing away your life to Bank America, but you're giving them a lot of access to your private life whenever they want it. And that's pretty scary. Now, the rationale, as John McAfee pointed out, was that if you were to pull $50,000 out of your Bank of America account, you know, that your phone basically has become an ATM. You can't get the physical dollars out, but you could easily transfer them to another bank where you could get the physical dollars or to a brokerage account or something like that. And so ATMs have cameras and microphones. So if you go to, you know, if you go to Bank of America and you say, hey, you know, $50,000 is missing from my checking account, maybe I should use, you know, $500 because, you know, most people don't have $50,000. That was the example McAfee used. Anyway, he apparently has $50,000 in his checking account. He says, $50,000 missing from my checking account, and it wasn't me. And then the bank can say, bah, au contraire, monsieur, here is the photograph that we took of you transferring the money at that very moment. And then you have to say, oops. Or they can say, ah, attempted fraud, and throw you in jail. And Bank of America isn't the only big bank or corporation, assuming John McAfee's story is true, using terms and conditions to barge in on your private life. Capital One, another giant bank, has just sent out a new contract update with new terms and conditions for its credit card holders. The LA Times, a reporter at the LA Times, read them. And they say the bank makes it clear it can drop by anytime it pleases. The LA Times writes that the new terms and conditions specify that the bank, quote, may contact you in any manner we choose, end quote, including emails, calls, texts, and faxes. Okay, that's not terrible, but then comes the part when Capital One says it might make personal visits, which could be at your home or at your place of employment. So say you're a Capital One credit card holder and you forget to make a monthly payment. According to the terms and conditions that you just agreed to, Capital One can come to your office and harass you to make that payment. Or if you've left work for the day, bank representatives could come to your home. And if you're lucky enough to avoid a personal visit from Capital One, the bank can still call you at all hours of the night, and they can do so without even telling you that they're the bank. That's because the new terms and conditions also state that the bank, quote, may modify or suppress caller ID and similar services and identify ourselves on these services in any manner we choose, end quote. Many people might interpret this to mean that Capital One can trick you into thinking you're getting a call from your doctor's office or your mother-in-law, and it's all perfectly legal. And this is just another mind-boggling example of how corporations have run amok in America, and you know, nothing's happening to stop them. This is a symptom of a, frankly, a larger problem, and I'm willing to use the F word. This is fascism in the 21st century. Now, historically, when we talk about fascism, we think about Mussolini and his replacement of the elected parliament with corporate representatives back in the 30s. After all, he invented the word fascism to describe the merger of corporate and state interests. And today, when we talk about fascism, we talk about how corporations are buying off politicians in Washington, taking control of our democracy. But what about fascism that doesn't even involve governments except to enforce contracts? Are we witnessing a new era of fascism where corporations are creating these intrusive and overbearing terms and conditions that you and I click on and agree to without even reading them? I mean, if so, then corporations in America have acquired king-like powers. Well, we're the poor serfs who have to just do everything that they say. Or we can't use their app, or we can't use their bank, or we can't, you know, go to that doctor, or we can't, the hospital won't take us in if we don't say, yeah, sure, you can sell my medical information. Come on. Enough is enough. Don't you think it's time for us all to start saying, wait a minute? Hold on, guys. This has gone too far. We had this conversation. I'm pretty sure it was during the Clinton administration. If my memory's off, it might have been the Carter administration, but I'm pretty sure it was during the Clinton administration that we passed legislation that, for example, when you sign a mortgage contract or, you know, basically bank contracts, that there has to be a version that's in plain English that the average person with a high school, you know, average high school graduate can read. Well, those terms and conditions may be in that form, but nobody clicks on the link and reads them. I mean, the web has made it much easier for these companies to bury these things. I mean, they're not buried. It's right there, the link. You know, please click on the link and then click the box saying that you've read it. And what do? You could just click the box. Hey, I'm in a hurry. I don't have time. And if you did read it, you'd probably go nuts. You know what? I'm giving up my rights under the Constitution? Really? I actually signed a mortgage back in the 90s where in the mortgage, I actually sat in the bank, which totally frustrated the banker. Louise and I were sitting there, and Louise was, I think, rather embarrassed by this, but, you know, what the heck. I was in the mood, and I said, I'm going to read this contract before I sign. It was 14 pages. And there was one line that said, I hereby give up my rights under the 6th and 14th Amendments, as I recall. That would be a right to a jury trial and a right to equal protection with this contract so that the bank can determine if I want to sue them. That, no, I can't have a jury trial. I have to go to arbitration. And the bank can decide, you know, what rights I have. I mean, it was bizarre. And I said, I'm going to X these out. And the guy said, you X them out, you're not going to get the mortgage. And so I signed the damn thing. But it's like, what are we going to do? I mean, we need to establish clear guidelines on what corporations can and can't do. And we need to put those guidelines into law so Bank of America can't spy on you in your bedroom and Capital One can't come running into your workplace. We need big government now. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, it gets right down to who are you gonna trust, a Wall Street bankster who's accountable to no one, or your elected representative who you can throw the bomb out every 2 years? And welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour, and Deidre watching Free Speech TV in Congress, Arizona. Hey, Deidre, thanks for watching the show.
Hey,
what's
Tom,
up?
How are you doing today?
I am fine. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine. It's beautiful weather here in Arizona.
So what's up?
Oh, the gentleman that was on there on your previous hour, regarding oil drilling, you know, and the possibility of pockets being opened up underneath, you know.
Yeah.
I was wondering that myself, and I wish you had a geologist on there we could talk to about this.
Well, I have talked to geologists before about this, and
did they say anything like that? Or
yeah, here's what I've heard, is that the bigger concern is water drilling. With oil drilling, when you pump that oil out, what tends to happen is if the rock is fairly porous, then those oil wells fill up with water. And in fact, in some cases, the oil extraction process involves injecting water, particularly warm water under pressure, into the oil wells and pushing the oil out, because oil is lighter than water. And so as you push the water in, the oil from the bottom of the well comes up back out. So the oil, so those holes end up being filled. On the other hand, there are places where when you pump out the water, you end up with giant empty caverns, particularly in limestone areas. And if the what's called the refresh rate or the replenish rate is not equal to the exhaustion rate, the rate at which you're pulling the water out, then those caverns can become very dangerous. And that's the source of a lot of sinkholes that you see, particularly in places that are built on very, very porous rock like much of Florida.
Well, what about... Well, I was wondering, you know, they were talking the other night about all these earthquakes they're having in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And that's from oil drilling, right?
It seems that most of that is from fracking, and it's not even from the fracking itself, because the fracking is really, really deep. Instead, it's from the injection wells that they drill to dispose of the waste material.
Right.
The fracking chemicals are enormous quantities of water mixed with what used to be toxic and poisonous chemicals that were the byproducts of refining gasoline that the refineries used to have to pay to dispose of. And now they give or sell this stuff to the fracking companies, or they are the fracking companies. And after they've used them for hydraulic fracturing as a lubricant, the stuff is left over, but now they've got to find something to do. So they do what's called injection wells. They drill a well a few thousand feet into the ground and just blow it underground under high pressure. And the earthquake swarms seem to be associated more often with the injection wells than with the fracking.
Ah, well, I was wondering too, is that from the cracking of the rocks as they're going through?
Yeah, it's from the cracking of the rocks or the distortions in the pressures, the natural pressures underground that are the consequence of that water being put in under thousands of hundreds of thousands of pounds of
one
pressure per square inch.
Yes. Okay, I was just wondering how that worked.
Yeah.
Okay.
See, with the fracking, they're cracking up soft rock, right? With the fracking, they're cracking up shale, and which is soft rock. It's like half the carbon of oil. It never was worth recovering until they figured out how to frack gas out of it. So that, you know, that's fairly, that doesn't, it's like, it's not like a structural part of the earth, but when they do the disposal wells, they will drill right into like granite formations or sandstone formations. First is hard, the second is really soft, and inject that water. And that water then goes into cracks and that changes the physical dynamic. This is my understanding of it from having this geologist. Now, that changes the physical dynamics of the ground in a way that it predisposes it to earthquakes. So, Deidre, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us. And Rich in Aurora, Colorado, listening to us on AM 760 there in Denver. Hey, Rich, thanks for calling. You wanted to talk about Matt Taibbi's most recent piece on finance and econ?
Yeah, good afternoon to you, Tom. I love the show. Just a quick thing about banks.
every American ought to pull their money out of banks and put it in credit unions. And when I go to the ATM, Tom, I stick a thing up over the camera so they can't see me.
Oh, interesting.
Using it.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you've read Matt Taibbi's article yet, but this is a scary article.
It's a brand new piece?
It is a brand new piece. It's the current issue with Philip Seymour Hoffman on the cover. It's issue 1203, February.
Well, we're going to have to get Matt back on the show and talk about it. No, I haven't read it.
Oh, it is frightening and extreme. I'll just give you a quick. But basically, what it is explains about the destruction of Graham Leach Bliley and the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956 and Glass-Steagall. That was the Bank Holding Company Act of 56 and Glass-Steagall destroyed by
Graham Leach Bliley.
And what it is now is it's the banking companies in the business of owning oil tankers, running airports, controlling huge quantities of coal, natural gas, heating oil, electric
food,
power, precious metal.
Food. I mean, the Goldman Sachs, food index is one of the things that caused the riots a couple of years ago in third world countries. Anyhow, back to you. Bernie Sanders comes on all the time and says, you know, about a third of the cost of your gasoline is the banks skimming profit off the top because they're speculating in oil stocks.
Right. What they're also doing too is the more scary thing is they're in the purchase of uranium business. After 9/11, we were all worried about foreigners running ports and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is what something he said in the article. But we have no regulation of banks running uranium. And literally there is no watchdog. I mean they're writing their own rules. As Matt pointed out in the article, it'd be like a bookie betting houses in Vegas taking bets on sports team football. And then actually being the coaches of those teams. And what's going to happen here, there's a quote in here, says from The Dark Knight, he says, the storm isn't coming, the storm is already here. This is going to be one of the factors, and I haven't read your book yet and I want to, but this is definitely going to be one of the factors that's going to cause a crash in 2016 along with the real estate. It's just completely unmitigated, unchecked.
Well, that's one of the core premises of my book is that the crash of 2008 never went away. We're still in it.
Right.
They're just reinflating the bubble to try and hold off the disaster. And the reason why it never went away and the reason why it hasn't been resolved and the reason why it will crash again is because the damage of Graham Leach Bliley was never undone. I mean, Graham Leach Bliley was Ken Lay's brainchild. That and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. These are two pieces of legislation that Phil Graham pushed through the Senate and pushed through Congress at the behest of Ken Lay. His wife Wendy was on the board of directors of Enron, and to enable Enron to make a fortune and to get those pesky banks off their back.
Right. Well, does
Matt get into that at all?
Yeah. There's also he mentions in here about the utilities and running, and obviously, and I don't know if you've seen the movie, you know, Enron, the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah, I saw it a couple of years ago when it came out.
Right. He talks about, but he says it's just that, you know, it's taken now 15 years, and apparently, you know, we're now just waking up to it, and but the damage has already been done, and what they're using actually taxpayer-based subsidies to sit on these and they're sitting on things like zinc. And they're sitting on copper, and they're sitting on all these precious metals. They're in holding houses. It's called arbitraging the contango.
Yep.
And it says basically you're storing oils or metals, and you're doing works best if the cost of storing your oil or metals or whatever you're dealing with, whatever commodity, is negligible. You make more money in the futures trade if you don't have to pay rent while you wait to deliver. And the Koch brothers have got their little. The cockroach brothers, I call them, got their little paws in on this deal, you know. They have oil tankers, and they're basically just sitting with oil offshore, holding it and driving up the prices, you know.
And now they're arguing. I mean, there's a law right now that was passed back in the 1970s, right after the Arab oil embargo, that makes it illegal for oil that was drilled on the North American continent to be exported from North America. And there is the result of that is that because we're producing a lot of oil in North America, the price of oil is relatively cheap, and our price of gasoline is relatively cheap compared to other countries around the world. And in fact, the price of Texas sweet crude is about $10 a barrel below that of Brent crude. Brent is the off the coast of England and Norway, and Texas, of course, is from Texas. And so they're trying to get that. There's a real, real full court press here going on in D.C. with millions and millions of dollars of lobbying money, huge campaign contributions to mostly Republican lawmakers to change that law so that it is legal to export petroleum, raw petroleum products and or unrefined petroleum products. This on top of the fact that last year the number one export from the United States was gasoline and diesel fuel, refined petroleum products. If they can export the unrefined ones, then our costs are going to go up substantially. And by the way, if this coincides with Keystone XL, then it's all the perfect storm. Rich, I'll have to check it out. I'll have to get Matt Taibbi on. Thanks for the FYI, for the heads up. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. It is always nice to be at the nexus of the smartest people on the planet, right here in this program, the Tom Hartman Program. The place where smart people get their news and often give the news. Thanks again. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And someone today is going to get, I was going to say win, but we're just going to give away a free copy of my new book, The Crash of 2016, apropos of all this. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very pornorastically ugly. Brought to you by the organic wine company, EcoWine.com. The good, Governor Pat Quinn, the Democratic governor of Illinois, has made paid sick leave for all of his state's employees a top priority. His budget team is currently putting together a bill that would allow both full and part-time workers in the state of Illinois, not just his state's employees, in the state of Illinois, to accrue 2 paid sick days each year according to how many hours they work. While not as expansive as the paid sick leave laws in other developed countries, Governor Quinn's bill is a good start. No American, no matter where they work, should have to choose between keeping a job and going to work sick. And frankly, as an employer, it's just a dumb idea to demand that your employees go to work when they're sick. The bad, Bill O'Reilly. During Monday's episode of The Factor, the Fox News host went on an epic rant about what he called the rise of ignorant America. O'Reilly blamed the Internet for the fact that many people do not know the basics of current events, but made sure to point out that his viewers, and by proxy Fox News viewers, were more informed than most.
We are a country in decline, primarily because 320 million American citizens aren't paying attention. They do not seem to be interested in the welfare of their country. They are primarily interested in their own welfare. Once again, I'm generalizing, and I have a caveat. I'm not pandering here. Those of you watching this broadcast right now are most likely not in the ignorant category. You are taking the time to watch a news program to get information and analysis.
Right. Actually, Fox News viewers are not so well informed. In fact, a recent study found that people who watch Fox News are less informed than people who don't watch the news at all. If Bill O'Reilly were really concerned about ignorant Americans, he'd take his own show off the air. And the very, very ugly, Michael Dunn. Fresh off his mistrial on charges of the first-degree murder of 17-year-old Jordan Davis, the so-called loud music killer is already embroiled in a fresh controversy. The Florida State Attorney's Office has released Dunn's jailhouse calls to his fiancée, and in one of the calls, he can be heard saying that he is the real victim. Check this one out.
I know you're innocent, baby. I know you did something that you wish you hadn't had to do, but you did what you had to do. And so
look,
I know.
You know, I was thinking about that today. I was like, I'm the f***ing victim here. I was the one who was victimized. I mean, I don't know. How else to put it? It's like they attacked me. I'm the victim.
Right.
I'm the victor, but I was the victim too.
Michael Dunn is alive and Jordan Davis is dead, but Dunn thinks people should feel sorry for him. That's very, very ugly and a little bizarre. It's a lot bizarre. Speaking of Bill Riley and Fox News, this is hysterical. It's over at addictinginfo.org is the website. And do they have all 50? Yeah, I've got all 50. Oh, this is so cool. I'm gonna bounce around here. You might be watching too much Fox News if you are outraged about the ways that President Obama has just destroyed, just shredded the Constitution, but you can't name any rights that you've lost. You might be watching too much Fox News if you think that all the cold weather in the middle of winter is proof that there's no such thing as global warming. If you call Afghanistan Obama's war, you're watching too much Fox News. If you think there's no way Chris Christie knew about the scandal. Actually, you know, it's like last night, Louise and I did not even turn on MSNBC. And this is, I'm not knocking MSNBC. We do a TV show until 8 o'clock and I get home typically around 8:30 and, watch the last half of Chris Hayes' show and Rachel's show and then we go to bed. And, when I got home, Louise had stayed home yesterday and she was watching something else altogether. And so I just sat down, we had dinner and, you know, we didn't watch the news, and I said, you know, how come you didn't turn on the news? And she's like, you know, if I turn on Fox, all it's going to be is Benghazi. And if I turn on MSNBC, all it's going to be is Chris Christie. And I said, well, you know, I don't think it's quite that bad, is it? And she's like, okay. She pushes the button. It pops out of Netflix and into TV, right? It goes out of the web, and because the TV's, we've got a TV set that's connected both to the web and to the cable. And whose pictures full screen on the screen? Chris Christie. We're on the MSNBC channel. And for about 3 or 4 seconds, and she says, see? And she pops back to the movie. And like an hour later, I said, you think they're still talking about Christie? And she says, let's find out. Hits the TV button. Bang. Hey, did you know about the police officer union with Chris Christie? It's like, geez. Even Bill Maher is getting upset about it. Anyhow, you might be watching too much Fox News. I mean, yeah, I think Chris Christie's just another corrupt politician. Surprise. But, you know, I don't live in New Jersey. And he hasn't declared his candidacy for Republican president, you know, for president of the United States as a Republican candidate yet. And I think it's fine if you're going to take him down before then. But there's other things going on in the world. I have not heard a word from our so-called liberal network about the end of net neutrality. Have you? I mean, maybe I missed it. U.S. Circuit Court says no to net neutrality. I think this is like the biggest story in America. I mean, we did 2 days on it, and I talk about it every day, at least a little bit. Or our insane trade policies or the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anyway. You might be watching too much Fox News if you denounce Bill Clinton as an adulterer but give a pass to David Vitter and Mark Sanford. They apologized after all. I thought Clinton apologized. Oh, but he's not a Republican. That's it. Right. If you swear that Obama's coming for your guns, you might be watching too much Fox News. If you constantly complain about the liberal media, but then you're horrified because Obama said you didn't build that. You might be watching too much Fox News if you think that voter fraud is a real problem, but you can't explain how cutting early voting stops voter fraud. Or that you hate Obama for not serving a day in the military, but you voted for Mitt Romney, who never served a day in the military. Anyway, it goes on and on. It's just, you know, it's like,
But the here's another another disturbing story. Actually, I'm going to get to this in the next hour. Data pioneers watching us work. Hannah Kuchler at Kuchler, writing over at the Financial Times. But for the moment, Mark in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. You wanted to talk about natural gas and the environment, Mark?
I did. I've been listening for quite a while, but earlier in the day, you were talking about fracking and everything else, and it just amazes me that people are not intelligent enough when it comes to what our actual needs are to be a little bit, to err on the side of caution a little bit more.
Mm.
Deep well horizon, fracking, what we're dumping into our landfills.
I don't think it's a lack of intelligence. I think it's a lack of information. I don't think they're well informed enough.
It's funny that you say that, because that's what I was going to talk about, that was going to lead into my next part of this conversation, which was what you talk about. And I think it was a fairness doctrine, or was it freedom of information?
No, the fairness doctrine was the FCC rule that was put into place back in the 20s or 30s that said that if you're going to use the public airwaves, you have to give back to the public by performing a public service. And that was broadly interpreted by the FCC over, a half a century as being that you actually gave news, real news, to people.
Yeah.
Well, and Reagan blew that up in 87.
It goes back to what you talked about, Thomas Jefferson saying that, key, to a healthy functioning democracy is an educated electorate. And it's
educated and informed. Yes.
Yeah, and it's just to the point now that, although I strive to, think and help things be, better in my community, I'm thinking about trying to get a cooperative going and some other things that, that I think can be a positive thing. But it's just, it seems that the task seems overwhelming because every subject that you talk about is all tied to this 1% that we talk about, or that, 1,000th of 1%. And it's just amazing to me that people can't see that word that you didn't want to say earlier, fascism, involved in our everyday lives.
I think people are starting to see it, Mark. I really think they are.
I hope so, because it's it's pretty scary if we, as voters, can't vote for politicians that are going to represent our...
We go through cycles in America, We go through cycles in America of figuring things out. We go through cycles in America of making horrible mistakes. We go through cycles. And I think that, the wheel's turning. The wheel is turning. I'm actually quite optimistic. Mark, would you like a copy of The Crash of 2016, or do you have one?
I would love a copy.
Okay, let me put you on hold. Shane would like you to have one. Hang on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Danielle Mark is on line 7, and he's our book recipient for the day. Good on you, Bart. I hope you enjoy reading. We'll be back. Welcome back. And Detroit Johnny O watching Free Speech TV in Romulus, Michigan. Hey, Johnny O, how you doing?
Buongiorno, amigo.
Johnno? Okay. What's up, Johnno?
I'm doing fine, amigo. I just was thinking about that fracking tax, man. That's a great idea you got there. How come it hasn't been done, before? How come nobody thought about that?
Well, it's been done. It's been done all. China has started a carbon tax. I think it went into effect at the beginning of this year. It might be in the summer of this year. Many of the European countries have had carbon taxes for years. And the entire European Union has had a carbon cap and trade program going on for a couple of years. And so, there have been a lot of attempts to put a price on carbon. It just hasn't happened in the United States.
Yeah, I thought BP and ExxonMobil don't pay taxes.
No, well, they do.
That impression, they don't pay taxes.
Yeah, last year I think both of those companies paid a fair amount of taxes because they just had such mind-boggling profits they couldn't bury it anymore. But a few years back, ExxonMobil was quite famous for having a year where they paid no taxes. But it might have been just a bad market year or something. But, they pay a lot less in taxes as a percentage of their income and revenues than you and I do. I can tell you that.
And then they got breaks and loopholes and all kinds of garbage. You get the money back.
Because they own legislators.
Well, of course, but that's just, that stuff should stop. And you know that as well as I do.
Yeah. Can you imagine if I could just call up, you know, 10 or 20 members of Congress and say, hey, you know, come on over to the Hayes Hotel or Hayes, what is it? Hayes, John, there's a fancy hotel here in town, Hay, whatever it's called. And come on over to this hotel and meet with me, and I'd like to have a conversation with you about inserting a line into the tax code that says that people who make their living as talk show hosts only pay a 5% maximum income tax, or that talk show hosts like bankers can call their income carried interest and pay a maximum 20% income tax instead of the maximum 39% income tax. I mean, wouldn't that be
nonprofit like the NFL?
It's, I mean, if you when you think about doing it yourself, what you know, when I think about, you know, hey, I don't have enough mojo or enough cash to do that. But if I were to even try, I would think that that is corrupt. And yet that's what the banksters have done. I mean, they got themselves a loophole called the carried interest loophole, which is exclusively for banksters and hedge fund managers. The oil company got the oil industry has themselves a whole bunch of loopholes. It's like the genetically modified food industry has a bunch of loopholes. You name a major industry, the telecommunications industry, you name an industry and I can find you loopholes that they've got. They, you know, ways to avoid paying taxes. But the average working person, not a chance.
Yeah, well, I hope we can get this tax happening before 2016 when the fracking queen takes over the White House.
The fracking queen?
Yeah, Hillary.
Oh, Hillary's...
She's in their back pocket, too.
Yeah. Well, she... you know, it's interesting how people get in and out of pockets. President Obama... Well, actually, we'll see. We'll see how this shakes out. I don't want to make any predictions, because I could be wrong. But I really think that it's not so much, you know, Obama or Clinton or Elizabeth Warren or, you know, pick your politician is good or bad as much as it is, are they responsive to the parade or not? And that then raises the larger question, you know, how big a parade can we pull together? Because, you know, there's got to be enough of us that we're louder than the parade of the billionaires. Johnny O, thanks a lot for the call. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Harbin here with you, back with you. And let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, the only animal group that gives you a picture of your goat and the recipient. And it was started by Ellen Ratner, who is the grand poobah of the Talk Radio News Service. And hey, how you doing, Victoria?
I'm doing great, thank you.
It's very nice to see you today.
Thank you.
So what's going on in the world?
Well, economists are excited.
Economists?
Yes. How about that?
Excited about what?
They're excited because Americans ramped up their borrowing at the end of last year as their confidence improved, posting the largest increase in household debt since before the recession. Now, they count household debt as mortgages, credit cards, auto loans, and student loans. It jumped $241 billion, or 2.1%, between October and December to $11.52 trillion, according to new figures today from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
So
that was the biggest quarterly rise since the third quarter of 2007.
So consumer debt in the United States is over $11 trillion?
Yes.
And there's people running around with their hair on fire because the federal government, which has a lot more assets than any consumers, I mean, Purple Mountains, Majesty, and everything else, is, what, $15 trillion, $16 trillion in debt?
Yes.
But we, the people, were $11 trillion in debt? That doesn't sound like good news to me.
Well, no, they think it's a good thing because we owe the money, but we're more confident enough in our finances to borrow again after years of shedding the debt we accumulated before the financial crisis.
I understand. And what that says to me is that we're blowing the bubble back up again.
Well, it could be. Or it could just be that we're feeling a little bit safer.
Yeah.
Because apparently at the same time, consumers are showing signs of caution.
Well, let me read you a headline from today's Financial Times.
Yes.
Tracy Alloway, New York, writing. This is the headline. You can derive everything from this. It's just six words. U.S. lenders return to securitized mortgages.
Yes.
Ta-ta-da.
Exactly.
We're back to 2006.
Exactly. Well, they said consumers are showing signs of caution because it showed that new originations of mortgages fell for a second quarter in a row to $452 billion, probably due to higher interest rates.
That's interesting.
Yes. Yes, I thought so too. So generally they think that was a positive sign, nevertheless, but maybe it could be the beginning of a bubble. It's probably too early to tell, I think is what they would say, because it's a quarter.
Yeah.
And probably this quarter may not be too good because of the weather.
The weather and the sequester.
Possibly that too.
A lot of people got laid off. Plus, you know, people who lost their unemployment benefits, they, of course, may not be borrowing, may not have the ability to borrow, and maybe never did. But now they're in such desperate straits that they're hitting on their brother-in-law for a loan. And, you know, or they're running up their credit cards right now in the hopes that, Republicans will finally relent and stop filibustering the extension of long-term unemployment benefits so that, you know, they'll get some money and they'll be able to pay down their credit card debt.
Right.
That's a
scary
scenario.
So I asked Jay Carney, the White House spokesman today, whether Obamacare, including the rollout, was going to be an asset or an albatross for Democrats in the midterms.
Mm-hmm.
And part of a very lengthy answer was that the Democratic Party is not going to lose control of the Senate, in our view. The party would prevail precisely because the president and Democratic lawmakers are focused on expanding opportunity as opposed to repealing policy items like Obamacare, feeling that that approach is one that, broadly speaking, the American people support. Also, he said that as a general principle, without gaming out election strategies, because he's not the campaign office, it's a difficult case to make, despite the well-documented polling data on Obamacare, for Republicans to say they want to take away the benefits that the Affordable Care Act provides.
Don't you think a really simple and straightforward and honest answer to that question, you know, is Obamacare going to be an asset or an albatross for Democrats in the midterm elections, would be, it depends on where you live?
That might be too short an answer for Jay.
I mean, in Kentucky, they've expanded Obamacare tremendously, and everybody loves it. In Louisiana, Bobby Jindal has refused to expand it, and you got a bunch of poor people who are really, really angry, and they're not sure who to be angry at, so it might as well be the president, because they got nothing.
I think he was thinking in terms of the big policy question, not in terms of that. But I think you make a very valid point. And I think it also depends on who you are. If you're Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire, it may not be so good for you.
Because it's such a Republican state?
No, not so much, because she was pretty safe until a few months ago when she's being zapped with enormous money ads.
Oh, by the Koch brothers.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
So then the answer becomes, it depends on whether the Koch brothers have decided to take you out.
That's part of it, and that's probably not an answer that you're going to get from Jay Carney.
Right.
The Congressional Budget Office has done a study on raising the minimum wage. It found a couple of interesting things. It found that raising the minimum wage to $10.10 would boost the income of about 16.5 million workers, raising their income to a total of $31 billion. It also found that raising the minimum wage to $10.10 would reduce employment by 500,000 in 2016, compared to if Congress left the minimum wage at $7.25 per hour. Now, that was attacked immediately by Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat of Iowa, the lead sponsor of the Senate bill to raise the minimum wage.
Right. I would say that that number does not include the effect of those people spending that extra money.
Right. He said more than 600 economists, including seven Nobel Prize laureates, recently affirmed the growing consensus that low-wage workers benefit from modest increases in the minimum wage. And he went on to talk about an analysis reveals that gradually raising the minimum wage to $10.10 would raise the wages of nearly 28 million low-wage workers, pumping $22 billion in the economy, and contrary to the CBO report, would create 85,000 jobs over 3 years due to increased consumer demand, is what Harkins maintained.
Right. That's interesting that the CBO would come out with numbers that seem so partisan.
And they were not asked for this report either.
Interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our president, the pothead? Really? Kevin Jackson is on the line with us. He's the executive director of the Black Sphere, S-P-H-E-R-E, columnist and syndicated radio host. TheBlackSphere.net is the website. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us. The Opiate of the Masses is the title of the piece on your website, theblacksphere.net. And you ask, why are legislators rushing to propose legalization of marijuana? To understand this, I believe we need look no further than Karl Marx. I've actually read both Capital and the Communist Manifesto, which Engels co-authored, and found no reference to drugs anywhere in there. What are you talking about?
Well, your producers probably should have told you. Scott Muncher is a writer that writes for me there, mm-hmm. and they ask, you know, what were my thoughts on it? I think that though I certainly don't believe everything that my writers write about, what I do believe is that we have become a nation that says, you know, let's sort of make it a free-for-all when it comes to drugs. And for the record, I'm one of these people that says if you're an individual, do what you wish. If I happen to be traipsing about in the forest and stumble upon a mushroom and it looks enticing to me and I want to go through a hallucinogenic trip, who's to stop me?
But well, I do believe the federal government right now.
Well, you know, well, that's the point. The federal government would. But the point is that we're starting to go down this slope, and I think that the government should be genuine in saying what it's really after, which is tax revenue. Government has proven that it's willing to allow drugs to be used if it can get revenue for it from it. Cigarettes are a good example. Liquor is another good example. And the legalization of marijuana – you know, you would think that the lobbies for the anti-cigarette lobbies and things like that would be fighting this tooth and nail because the studies are that marijuana is worse on your lungs than cigarettes. Who wants secondhand smoke, Tom?
Studies don't actually say that.
Yeah. Well, studies do say that. We can both cite studies that say one thing or the other.
I don't think you can, actually.
Well, yes, I can.
Give me a citation then.
I'm not on your show to give you that. I can guarantee you that there are people that say smoking of marijuana or cannabis is as bad, if not worse, for your lungs than cigarette. But I would ask you this. Should I be breathing in anybody's smoke, whether it's skunk weed or cigarettes? Cannabis smells like skunk. Why would I want to breathe that in a restaurant any more than a cigarette? But nobody says anything because there's a potential to bring it up and get money from it. Be genuine about it. I don't care if people want to smoke marijuana. I wouldn't.
I agree with you, Kevin. I don't want anybody blowing smoke in my face, whether it's pot smoke or tobacco smoke, any more than I want them spraying cocaine in my face. But that's got nothing to do with decriminalizing pot for private use in your own home.
You know what? If you want to decriminalize pot, do it. But I'm saying be genuine about it with respect to take the same approach that you would take with cigarettes. Take the same approach that you would take with liquor.
Well, that's what they're doing.
What do you mean that's what they're doing?
Colorado and Washington State are both taxing pot. And California taxes medical pot.
Okay, so let me ask you this. The federal government right now says that it is illegal to have those drugs, but right. They just relaxed the banking laws to say that you can put your money in a federal bank, in effect, laundering the money that comes from pot because the Fed is not for it. So, again, spiraling in on itself, it's one or the other. Either you want it and you say, we condone it, we're going to tax it, it's legal, do what you want to do with it. But if it's not, don't let the banking system get a hold of it, because that's essentially what the federal government is saying. Barack Obama has personally said, I don't think pot's that big of a deal. Okay, if you believe that, then work towards it. Don't be disingenuous about it.
He has the power to take it off Schedule 1 and make it a Schedule 2 or 3 or 4 drug, make it basically a prescription drug. Tomorrow morning, and I personally think the reason he hasn't done it is political cowardice.
There's political cowardice because I don't know if you realize the stats, but 13 prescriptions per man, woman, and child in this country. We spend $898. I have the stats in front of me. $898 per person on prescription drugs. Do it. You've got so many other drugs that you've legalized in one form or another. If you want to call it medicine, fine. I'm never going to take that medicine. But if people want to do it, don't be disingenuous. And that's kind of where I go with where government gets involved. They try to split too many hairs. Either you're for something or you're against it.
Okay. I don't disagree with any of that. Why then are you publishing an article that says, people pushing recreational drug use of pot are doing it based on Karl Marx because he said religion is the opium of the people. And then your writer goes on to say, one thing all good communists understand is it's easier to control people when they're weak, ignorant, or apathetic. Controlling Christians, however, can be problematic at best. Now you're saying Christians can stand up to this, but just a sentence earlier you had quoted Karl Marx saying that the opium of the people was not opium, it was Christianity, it was religion.
I won't call it a conspiracy. I don't think it's that far. But I do believe that there is something that says give the people sort of the thing that they want that's going to appease them. If it's drugs, let's face it, Tom, when we're on a chemical, we're not ourselves. Will we both agree with that?
By and large.
I think you would. By and large, we are. I know when I drink, I tend to just get a little lethargic. I don't think as clearly or whatever. I believe, and I think Scott does as well, who wrote the article, that by saying, let's drug the nation, I just gave you the stats, 13 prescription drugs per man, woman, and child, we're spending $898 per person.
No, so, I think we should ban advertising of this stuff. But did you drink coffee or tea today?
I did.
Do you do it every day?
I don't drink tea. I drink coffee about every day.
Yeah, okay. So I mean, we're all drug addicts here.
Well, look,
Kevin.
I mean, you can stretch caffeine and say that's a drug or whatever. There are chemicals in nature.
Caffeine's a drug.
You can say that caffeine is a drug, but caffeine's not a drug that's going to make me necessarily go and knock some old lady in the head to get more.
Well, I don't think pot is either. Caffeine is a psychoactive drug, and alcohol generally doesn't cause people to beat other people up to get more alcohol because it's legal.
I've seen some
argument for decriminalization.
I've seen some pretty mean drunks, but I'm not around drug culture enough to tell you definitively what potheads do or any other type of drug. But what I will tell you is we are a nation that has become dependent upon not caffeine, but drugs that certainly will alter the way that you behave. And I think that there is something to be said for having a culture that's just kind of a, hey, devil may care. I lived in China. And I will tell you, the Chinese, their approach to politics is, so we got a new prime minister, no big deal. Politics gets done to them.
Yeah.
They have no input.
Outside of Wall Street, where when the binge stuff was going on in the 80s and everybody was doing cocaine, my experience has been that when people have jobs, good jobs that they really like, and they life is good, they feel like they've got the American dream, they've got a middle class life, that they're not looking for drugs, they're not looking to get high, and that when things are falling apart, then drug use goes up. So shouldn't we be looking at the way 32 years of Reaganomics has eviscerated the middle class in America as being a more of a problem if we're if we've seen an increasing drug culture and we want to do something about it?
I don't know what the comment about Reaganomics. If there was a time to be using drugs in America, I would say it's under the Obamanation. If you want to look at why someone would decide to be desperate.
Yeah, the economy sucks. 32 years of Reaganomics has destroyed this country.
No, it isn't 32 years of Reaganomics. It's about five or six years.
It's been 32 years since we rebuilt, since we continued building our infrastructure.
Well, we can debate that one, Tom, but I will tell you, if you want to use drugs, this might be the time to do it.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, if they decriminalize it here in Washington, D.C., I might seriously consider. Kevin Jackson, theblacksphere.net is the website. Kevin, nice talking with you. Thanks for dropping by today. Thank you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, what do you think? Is pot the opiate of the masses? Or would that be opium? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's up?
Yes, I'm kind of enthusiastic about the opportunity to talk about a way we're going to stop pollution on trucks on the highway.
This is what Mr. Obama was talking about today.
The fuel right now is coal. Coal direct chemical looping uses iron ore, and it produces no pollution. And the byproducts of it are cement and iron ore, refined iron ore. So we could have all of our trucks running on steam.
Where do you? I understand the chemistry of what you're talking about, and it's like instantaneous sequestration and all that kind of thing. But
right.
I believe that it takes an enormous amount of energy to do that to coal. Where are you going to get that energy from?
Well, it's sort of a. In other words, you have to. Obviously, it's just like a starter. You have to start the reaction. And that reaction be close to combustion at the truck stops, and then the trucks could pull in, unload the spent fuel pods, and put in a fuel pod that's already heated up to close to combustion, and then the truck would then run on steam to the next truck stop.
Then the truck becomes a traveling bomb, doesn't it?
Well, every truck's a traveling bomb. I mean, they haul gasoline. That's kind
No, they haul diesel fuel. Diesel fuel doesn't explode the way gasoline does.
Yeah, diesel fuel is the second most powerful explosion known to man. Ask Saddam Hussein.
Well, you have to mix it with things like ammonium nitrate. You know, that's what Tim McVeigh did, the bomb that took out the McMurrah building in Oklahoma City. Was ammonium nitrate's fertilizer that had been saturated with kerosene, with diesel fuel.
No, you just put a primary explosion on diesel fuel and then a secondary spark, and it literally explodes at a higher rate of it, virtually sucks the oxygen out of people's lungs in a very large area. So it's the second most lethal. I guess the good news, quote-unquote, is we don't have
you ever tried to light diesel fuel, like, you know, a pool of diesel fuel on the ground on fire? It's pretty hard to do. I mean, gasoline is like no problem. You get a match there.
Yeah,
I mean, as a kid, I played with this stuff. I can tell you.
Well, I hauled 850 gallons of diesel fuel out every day of my life for the last 20 years. So, I mean, I know what is the, you know, the combustibility of diesel fuel. But in a military application, there's a nuclear bomb, then there's a exploding fuel air bomb, and then I guess there's TNT and whatever. But the point is that we have now, because of Lang Shi Pan at Ohio State University, we now have last February he perfected a coal direct chemical looping plant, and I don't know, it's not really getting up on the news too much, but, you know, problem is solved. It's just a question of applying the science to the problem.
Right.
And of course, the oil companies are frantically trying to get their product out on the ground quickly, because with China going to the moon, they'll be having helium-3 rockets coming back to the Earth, and then one helium-3 vehicle the size of the space shuttle would supply all the energy needs of China for 2 years. So.
Wow. Steve, you're tapping into some science that I'm not familiar with. I can't comment on it, but thank you for the call. We'll be back 20 minutes past the hour. Now, back in the late 90s, Louise and I owned an advertising agency in Atlanta, and we were renting the middle floor of a three-story building in Marietta, and the basement was rented by two other companies, we had the ground floor, and then the floor above us was rented by, or was offices for the guy who owned the building, and he owned several other buildings around us. And he was really a strange guy. He would come down at night when we weren't in the office and unscrew every other fluorescent bulb. We'd put them back on. He'd come back down when we weren't there and put them back on. We changed the locks. He got the locksmith out to change the locks back. Wanda, one of the women who worked for us, liked to sit out in the parking lot and smoke. She smoked, and you couldn't smoke in our office. And so she'd sit out there and have a cigarette. And while she was having a cigarette, she would, you know, have her lunch. And if she had some breadcrumbs and things, she'd toss them to the birds. And he said, "You can't. I don't want you feeding the birds in my parking lot on my property." And Wanda thought that was pretty arbitrary, and so she continued to feed the birds. So he went out and put rice out there, which birds eat and it kills them. It swells up in their stomach and explodes their stomachs. So he started killing the birds, so Wanda wouldn't feed them. Then we discovered that he was literally following some of our female employees home. And I was, you know, the first couple times I heard this, I was like, I don't know about this, you know. But then he followed my daughter, who didn't work for us, but was there a fair amount. She was last year of high school, and she had a car. And she would drop by after school and hang out with Louise. Louise ran the business, and I kind of ran the sales part and worked with the creative team. And Louise and I had started the company in 90. Whatever the year was. We started the company in 87, sold it in 96. And eventually we took this guy to court. We sued him to get out of the contract, to get out of the lease. And the judge just, you know, when he found out what this guy was up to, just threw the book at him. It was very interesting. And a friend of mine did the lawsuit for us just for the fun of it, because he was so horrified by what had happened. And it was a small claims court. So one and only time I've ever been involved in a lawsuit. So that's my background with being at work and having somebody watch me. Turns out he was monitoring us as we were working. He was looking in our windows. He was keeping track of when we were there. He would come in at night and turn the thermostats down really, really low. We had a whole bunch of computers. This was an advertising agency, and we were producing, you know, camera-ready copy. We had typesetting machines and computers, and we had to maintain a relatively stable temperature. Chemicals for photography. This is back in the 90s. I mean, digital photography wasn't where it is now. And in the late 80s. And we were like in this war with our landlord. So you can imagine my shock when I discovered that there are companies like Quantified Workplace or Evolve that monitor employees on behalf of employers. Evolve has pulled together more than $500 million employee data points from across 13 countries. Things like how often employees interact with their supervisors, how long it takes an employee to get to the office. Sociometric Solutions puts sensors in name badges and monitors how employees move around the workplace, who they talk to, and in what tone of voice. I'm reading from a piece by Hannah Kuchler, K-U-C-H-L-E-R, titled Data Pioneers Watching Us Work in Today's Financial Times. Steelcase, they make desks. I've had a Steelcase. I've had Steelcase desks. They make good office equipment. Steelcase puts sensors in office furniture and buildings to see how workers interact. David Lathrum, its director of our research and strategy, quoting from the article, says the sensors are now so cheap they can be put practically anywhere, everywhere, arguing that employees could benefit by tracking their own performance. Yeah. The U.S. National Right and Work Rights Institute is not impressed. Lou Maltby, the president, says, you know, this is a real problem. He says most employees haven't got a clue of the extent to which they're being monitored. The fact of the matter is that many employers monitor their employees' email at work. They monitor all of their computer usage, every web page they go to. I mean, everything that they're doing, basically. And in the process, they may well be picking up passwords and things. So you'd think that you could go to court and get out of this monitoring the way that we got rid of the crazy landlord. And I'm convinced the guy was actually crazy, that he was OCD, that he was nuts. I mean, killing birds, really? But Lou Maltby, the president of the U.S. National Work Rights Institute, says, quote, no employee has ever won an invasion of privacy case based on employer monitoring and employer monitoring their computer. Never happened. Isn't this bizarre? You ever been monitored in the workplace? I can't imagine. Maybe I'm just like, you know, an old fart. Maybe I'm just old school. I never post anything to Facebook, for example. Our show posts every day what we're up to, you know, but I don't go on and say, I'm going out with, Jenny and Bill tonight. Louise and I are going to pizza. No, I mean, my private life is my private life. And I would feel that way whether I was, you know, in front of 3 million people every day on TV and radio or not. And although I understand the impulse to share. I mean, you know, one of my sisters-in-law is a very big Facebook poster, and I like to go on Facebook and read her posts. I have a better sense of her life. But I would personally have a hard time doing that. But that's voluntary giving of information. What about the involuntary giving of information? How would you feel if you discovered that your name badge had been recording all your conversations? How would you feel if you discovered that your employer was watching everything you typed into your computer all the time? It's happening. Increasingly, trust me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Nova One, a U.S. company that runs customer call centers and has more than 2,000 employees, identified the characteristics of its most successful call operators and hired more people like them. Wow, a lot of the news. Okay, a lot of stuff we've talked about over the last 3 hours here, too. How Walmart money corrupts local politics. Did you see this? There is a Walmart store. Walmart wants to put a store in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And local citizens are somewhat ambivalent, apparently. And so all of a sudden, this group called Building a Better Sioux Falls starts sending out letters to people who live in the city telling them, oh, we should have a store on the south side of Sioux Falls. Won't it be great? It's grassroots, citizen-led, local organization. Turns out, this posted by Eureka Worker in Articles, over at Keoland. Building a Better Sioux Falls finance report lists an Arkansas man named Ryan Irsick as the group's chair. Irsick is also Walmart's senior direct manager of public affairs and governmental relations. The report shows the campaign is paid for by $250,000 contribution from Walmart Stores, Inc. Right. The data pioneers, the opiate for the masses. Oh, I shared with you the headline earlier from the Financial Times. Excuse me. U.S. lenders returned to securitize mortgages. We're back. 2006 derivatives. They're starting it up again. Oh, and has your Netflix been slow lately? Freepress.net would like to know. They just sent me a letter today. You probably got one too if you're on their website, on their mailing list. Netflix. Freepress.net. Dear Thomas, has your Netflix been slow lately? You're not alone. A mobile security company in Texas recently experienced major slowdowns while trying to connect to both its own website and Netflix. Why? It appears that Verizon was testing out its newly acquired powers to discriminate against certain types of online traffic. And I can tell you this happens. I've been, you know, I've pointed this out several times. Whenever I have two different internet providers. One is Wi-Fi, you know, the dongle kind of thing. And the other is through my cable provider here in Washington, D.C. And when I put virtual private network on, when I put a VPN on so that they can't read my content, so that they don't know what website I'm accessing, they just know how much data is flowing through, they immediately throttle the speed with which I can access data, in some cases down to zero. I have had times where I would have to wait a half a minute before data would start flowing again. And this is all just in the last couple of months. As freepress.net says, you know, if you want to change this policy, if you want to go back to net neutrality where your internet service provider, I mean, this is why, come on, let's tell the truth. This is why Comcast wants to buy Time Warner Cable. The two largest cable companies in the country merging together, and it's not about cable TV. Cable TV is dying. It's about the internet. It's about having wires into people's houses. And the fact that in most states, maybe every state now, I don't know, but in most states in the United States, they can say to you, you have to use our ISP, our internet service provider services, rather than anybody else's, because we own the copper. And I would say, but wait a minute, that copper's going over public rights of way. Isn't this at least in part a public utility? Our government invented the internet. Al Gore signed the legislation authorizing it, among others. No, that's actually true. So, but freepress.net says, we're up against the best funded, one of the best funded industries in Washington. AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon have spent more than $500 million on lobbyists. Now, I can tell you, I've been to some of the fanciest restaurants in this town. Business meetings, of course. Some of them actually, like the caucus room, Louise and I walked, their menu's out front. We used to live next door to it. And we walked over and just looked at the menu, and it was like $40 for an entree or whatever it was, you know, some incredibly high price. You know, geez, dinner's going to cost us $300. We just didn't even go. But I have, if not having been in some of the fanciest restaurants in this town, I've looked at the menus of some of the fanciest restaurants in this town. And I'm telling you, how many $300 dinners, well, add a $300 bottle of wine like Paul Ryan did, how many $600 dinners would you have to buy for legislators to spend $500 million? That's how much these companies have spent lobbying in this town. A half a billion dollars, $500 million. What could you possibly do with all that money? And an additional $185 million on campaign contributions. This isn't just helping out their campaigns. So freepress.net, their action fund, says we can do something about this. We're trying to push the FCC to reclassify broadband and pass strong net neutrality rules. Now, the question that I want to know is, why is the new head of the FCC, what's his name, Thomas something or other? Obama just nominated him, or just appointed him. He used to be a lobbyist for Verizon, I believe, or Comcast. Tom Wheeler, thank you. And will no doubt go back to being a lobbyist for Comcast when he's done, and a very paid, well-paid one at that, in all probability. I mean, who knows? But it's like, isn't it time to stop appointing corporate alumni to these positions? And isn't it time to bring back internet neutrality? And why isn't Netflix getting pretty fried about this? I'm sure that, you know, in their corporate boardrooms, they're gnashing their teeth. Boy, we should have bought, you know, whatever. So anyhow, a lot of interesting things going on right now. Let's get into a conversation with you. After all, this is a talk show. Andrew in Hollywood, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great. You want to talk about cannabis users?
Yeah. Well, there's two good things, at least, to talk about with cannabis or hemp, same plant, different strains, and both are big threats to economic interest in this country. Hemp, if we read Jack Harris, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, he has a picture of Henry Ford with one of his first cars, which was built to be powered by vegetable oil, right, which hemp you can get the oil from the seeds. And then the side panels, it shows a picture of him hitting with a steel rod, which were made out of hemp, the stock of the hemp itself, which can be a construction material, among other things. And he said it tested higher than steel.
Right.
So that's one issue there, is that hemp has an industrial use. Now, as far as medicinal and recreational use, first of all, for medicinal use, it could cure so many things. There's a great video now called Cannabis Rising on YouTube, which shows extracting cannabis extract, marijuana extract, and we just take two drops a day, and people are being healed of cancer, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Really good, and kids, all sorts of folks. And Rick Simpson in Canada was the one who, not pioneered it, but made it big. And he shows on his website, Phoenix Cheers, how it's done as well. And he's dealt with about 5,000 people dealing with ailments just using.
No, there's clearly some medicinal value there. And I personally know people who have gone through chemotherapy and used pot to stop the violent nausea and the horrors associated with that very successfully when no other prescription drug would work. And several people I know who have done that. But even if there was no medicinal value whatsoever, even if it was just an intoxicant, how many people in the last 100 years, I mean, we lose 50 to 100,000 people a year to alcohol in the United States, about half of them from physical body damage to their own body, cirrhosis, the liver kind of things, the other half from things like car crashes and you know, bar fights. How many people have died from pot in the United States in the last 100 years? I don't know of any. Do you?
No, I don't think there are any, because it makes you more passive, not passive, but mellows you out, makes you less violent. Or
more thoughtful, more introspective, more empathetic. That's certainly been my experience of using it, and it's been a lot of years, but I'll say that right up front, just like the President of the United States, Mr. Obama. I mean, the only way you can die from marijuana is if somebody drops a 200-pound bale of it on your head.
Sure. And can I say one more thing? Your guest,
Danielle's great
line. You just said if pot was, people would be hitting old ladies over the head to get it, and you made a great comment. Yeah, that's because it's illegal. You know, if coffee was illegal or tobacco, I'm sure all the people who line up at Starbucks or other places every morning, I drink a cup of coffee in the morning, and I'm a zombie if I'm not. I'm sure those people would be going to some extremes to get their cup of coffee or 10 cups of coffee a day.
Well, and there was actually a time when the Catholic Church made it illegal in Europe, you know, both caffeine and chocolate. And the Mormons, I mean, for the Mormons, it's not illegal, but it's a sin. All right, very, very interesting. Andrew, thanks for the call. I'm totally with you, and thanks for listening to KPFK in Los Angeles there. One of our many Pacifica affiliates. We're very honored and pleased to be on that radio station. I believe it's the largest radio station in the country. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, this is interesting. Netflix has finally spoken out on net neutrality. I'll tell you about that after the break. Welcome back. Frida in Fresno, California, watching us on Free Speech TV on the web, freespeechtv.org, or freespeech.org. What's up, Frida?
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I read your book, The Crash, and I wanted to say to you, we are feeling the effects of this downward economy in our household. And
you mean you personally?
Personally, yes. So that book really said a lot to me. And my daughter, she suffered 2 layoffs in the same year, last year. And in that year, my granddaughter, she graduated University of San Francisco. And and she's carrying a $40,000 student loan debt. And she's lucky to have two jobs, I don't know whether it's lucky, but she does have two jobs, two 20-hour jobs, and two 20-hour a week jobs. And it's so crazy what's happening here. And I wanted to ask you about the 401ks.
Mm-hmm.
You say that was like a scam or something, and I just wondered, how do you think that's going to fare with this downward economy?
Here's my take on 401ks. Back in up until the 1970s, most Americans either had savings or they had a pension, and or they were, you know, Social Security. Actually, in 1980, you could live on Social Security when you retired, and in most places in the United States. And so Americans had some retirement security, and pensions are really solid retirement security. With a pension, the company that administers the pension takes all the risk. You take no risk. You know, for example, my brother-in-law is a longshoreman. I believe it's long. He's a captain of a seagoing ship, you know, and he's within a year or so of retirement. And he knows when he retires that until the day he dies, he's going to get a certain number of dollars in his pension. And he knows when he retires how much money he's going to get from Social Security. He's got his retirement planned out. Regardless of what happens to the stock market, the risk is with the pension company. Well, the Reagan administration looked at this and they said, let's take that risk off Wall Street and put that risk into the hands of the individual citizens in America. And not only that, let's figure out a way that we can extract greater fees, because, you know, with a pension, you are paying a fee to the pension company. They do make a profit on the pensions. But let's figure out ways that Wall Street can make even more money. So if we give somebody a 401k and they invest in 35 stocks, they're now paying fees to 35, you know, for 35 different transactions. And we can make a lot of money off people's retirements. So that's what I said. You know, I don't think 401ks are in and of themselves a scam. It is a way to save money. You know, tax deferred, but the motivation was A, to cause average working Americans to start thinking as if they were investors and therefore think well of people who make their living investing and have some association with the capital gains tax, and B, to make more money for Wall Street. And they succeeded. They started with the IRAs, then they went to Roth IRAs, then they went to 401ks. Now there's all these exotic things. And it's just crazy. And I don't, you know, the solution to it in my mind, Frieda, is to roll back the Reagan Revolution, is to go back to pensions. But how we get there from here to there, that's one of the things that I don't have a clear answer for. Thank you for calling. Your more media support group for We the People, Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman program does not lead to stiff thinking, however. Charles in Hopewell, Virginia. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. Aqua Buddha?
Okay, look, I was listening to your first hour when you had Nate Sweet on, and you all were talking about the big picture.
Right.
So, I just have a question. I would like for you to not forget to bring up the point that you made, I think it was been about 3 weeks ago, about that activity with Rand Paul.
You mean when he was in college and he kidnapped that girl and took her out and made her bow to the god of Aqua Buddha in the stream?
Yes. So please don't forget that, because he's running around the country acting like he is, you know, holier than thou.
Yeah.
He's never done anything wrong. So please mention that.
Yeah, I've never met Rand Paul, but I have been on a train with him underneath the Capitol. They've got a train that goes back and forth between the Capitol and the Senate office buildings when he was talking to a few other people. And my sense of him, and it was consistent with my sense of him in the media, is that this guy is just a spoiled rich kid. You know, with this incredible sense of entitlement, you know, do this, do that, you know, and I don't know about this. And I think the Aqua Buddha incident is an example of that kind of frat boy, spoiled rich kid sentiment, Charles. So, yeah, thanks a lot for the call. Dave in Granite Bay, California. Hey, Dave, Fox News and militarization?
Well, the way that I came up with that was kind of thinking about when you talk about in cracking the code, how there's sort of two basic mindsets or worldviews in the two parties.
Right.
And the sort of nature of thinking about people. And then also George Lakoff, who sort of talks about those two mentalities of like the strict father figure and how that sort of aligns with the Republican mentality and that
versus the nurturing family.
Yeah. And to me, what that represents is that they've taken advantage of a kind of internalized authoritarianism that kind of runs rampant in that camp, I think. And to me, that's like the perfect fit with the basic war on everything that Fox News kind of like asserts itself with in terms of its authoritarianism. And I think that that's the result of the sort of trickle down militarism, like a la Chris Hedges thinking we have in America. That's just, I just wonder what you think of that.
I don't disagree at all. And John Dean, the old Nixon lawyer, who is now a legal scholar and a relatively frequent guest on this program, wrote an absolutely brilliant book about this called Conservatives Without a Conscience that I commend to you. And it's all about the authoritarian mindset, both among leadership and among followers. There are authoritarian followers and there are authoritarian leaders. And that is a personality type. And I think that that personality type is more drawn to the conservative movement and the Republican Party. So I think you nailed it, Dave. Robert in Joliet, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Robert, you wanted to talk about employers tracking their workers?
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I used to work at a freezer warehouse in Wilmington, Illinois. They would literally track you when you're in the bathroom, basically. You would have to punch in saying when you're going to the washroom.
Whoa.
And it would time how long you were there. People would get in trouble for that, and they would consider that personal time. It would be to the point where they would give you points and it would go towards discipline. I mean, I felt like, you know, that was like a violation of, you know, just my personal.
Did you feel like a lab rat in a maze? I mean.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, think about it when you could develop health problems when you're trying to hold in your, you know, your business.
Your urine, yeah.
And yeah, the longer you hold it, you're going to cause problems the longer, especially.
Oh, it'll blow your kidneys out.
Yeah, exactly. And then especially if you got to go number two, you know, hemorrhoids and all that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's a situation that people have to still have to deal with to this day. I mean, I didn't complain because I was young and naive, and I was 22, 23 years old, and I was making pretty good money, you know. But, I mean, now that I think about it, I'm like, wow.
That's pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing. The closest I've got, you know, Robert, thanks for sharing your story. That is grim. The closest I've gotten to that is when we had the ad agency, we did some contract work for the National Security Agency, the NSA. And I came here to D.C. and I was working in one of the NSA's offices. And I had to wear a badge that apparently had an RFID chip on it. And they've got on the floor these red, green, yellow, blue strips. And the color of your badge has to match the strip. And so if you're walking along a hall and it doesn't have a red strip on it and you're wearing a red badge, some sort of alarm goes off someplace. Every time I'd walk into certain rooms, a red siren type light would go off. I mean, it was pretty strange, you know, knowing that you're being continuously tracked wherever you are. And there was somebody who had to go with me to the bathroom whenever I went to the bathroom. But on the other hand, it was the NSA. So, you know, I have a. You know, I understand that, you know, that's a very different workplace from, you know, Acme Widget Company. I mean, come on. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, you wanted to talk about the corporations and democracy?
Yeah, you know, we're rapidly approaching a point where what democracy we have left is being taken over by the corporations. I believe the term is corporocracy.
Yeah, corporatocracy.
Technology is rapidly overcoming innate human intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they can monitor and check you these days is absolutely frightening. And the only hope I see for this country is, you know, we had 3.5 million young people serve in the last two wars. Now, my son is out, but he's still in. My daughter's same. My son-in-law's same. These people are going to be the informed citizens of the future because they've been there and done that. And my son was associated with JSOC.
Yeah.
And he's told me some stuff that would stand a hair up on the back of your head.
I imagine. Rick, I'm sorry we're flat out of time, but thank you for calling and sharing the story. And I think you're absolutely right. And this is the next generation, and they are going to have to pick up the baton and carry it forward. Coming up tomorrow, all the news you won't be hearing from the corporate media. I'll be taking your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires you to participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.